Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All hail, glorious St. Patrick. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all the Irish in the world, maybe except Joe Biden and Leo Varadkar and Michael Martin. Oh, perhaps I'd better not go there. Happy St. Patrick's Day to all and sundry. We'll be talking about the visit of the Irish delegation to the White House in Washington, but we'll be talking about bigger things too. We'll be talking about little Macron's declaration of war against Russia. That's right, having been thoroughly beaten by Niger and Burkina Faso, little Napoleon is off to Moscow. What could possibly go wrong? And we'll be talking about a bout of extraordinary division within the Palestinian National Movement just at the moment when they really didn't need it. And we'll be talking about little Rishi Sunak. Can he rally his troops even to get to the battlefield in the British general election, or will he be defenestrated long before then? Above all, I suspect perhaps we'll be talking about Gaza, about the catastrophe, the Nakba ongoing there. So fasten your seatbelts. It's the mother of all talk shows.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Well, it is St. Patrick's Day and much celebration and joy around the world by all of us, and I include myself in that, especially those with a connection to Ireland on my mother's side. I come from a long line of O'Reillys and Dugans and Floods, and very glad to be so. I grew up at my mother's milk, the occupation of Ireland, the long 800 years of British imperial oppression of Ireland. It's why it distresses me so to see people who should know better bowing the knee and handing over shamrocks to genocide Joe Biden. I appreciate there's another point of view, and I've tried my best not to be too harsh in my judgment of those who took the other position, that the Irish Republican movement has to go to Washington for a whole variety of geostrategic, geopolitical, and national reasons. I'm aware of those arguments. But I believe that this time, as the genocide in Gaza gathers pace rather than loses it, it was simply wrong to be seen in photo opportunities with genocide Joe Biden, not least because he won't even remember that you were there. He doesn't even remember that he was there for many reasons frequently adumbrated here on the Mother of All Talk Shows. But the bigger stories are these. The president of Russia would appear to have been re-elected in a landslide victory. And that means he's going nowhere. It means Russia's going nowhere. It means that it would be far better for Western leaders to come to terms with both of those facts. There's no opposition leader to President Putin except the one I would have voted for. And he is the presidential candidate of the Communist Party of Russia. So you probably don't mean him when you are told about opposition to Russia and opposition to the Russian government. That's right. It's either Putin or the communists. That is the choice of the people in Russia. There are no pro-Western liberal opposition candidates with more than a minuscule amount of public opinion on their side. And it's time that we abandoned the fantasy that there is. It's time that we abandon the fantasy that there's going to be regime change in Moscow. Abandon the fantasy that Russia is going to be broken up into what Western leaders injudiciously call its constituent parts. It's certainly true that Russia is a very, very diverse place. The idea that Russia is filled only with people who look like Putin is entirely wrong for anyone who knows the country. And therein lies the rub. The Western people in charge of our affairs have never understood Russia. They didn't understand it in Tsarist times. They certainly didn't understand it in Bolshevik times. And they don't understand it in the post-Bolshevik Putin era. That's the truth of the matter. What Mr. Churchill called a mystery inside a riddle, wrapped in an enigma, was expressing a long-held truth about the British ruling elite. For them, Russia is a puzzle. Russia is a mystery. Russia is an enigma. But for those of us who know it and love it well, and have done, in my case, for more than half a century, I have regarded Russia and Moscow deep in my heart. There's nothing mysterious about it. There's no enigma about it. Russia is a great European power and demands to be treated like one. It was happy to make nice with Western countries in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. Putin was ready to join NATO. Putin was ready to join the European Union. Putin asked your leaders over and over again, have heed to our security. Let's make a security apparatus together. Let's make an architecture of post-Soviet security architecture. Let's make it together so that none of us can ever threaten either or any of us ever again. But the time for making nice has gone because it was thrown back in the face of the Russians. Promises made have been not only not kept, but the very opposite of the promises have been implemented. When George Bush Sr. said that if you withdraw from Eastern Germany, Mr. Gorbachev, if you knock down the wall, Mr. Gorbachev, if you allow Germany to reunite, Mr. Gorbachev, we promise that NATO will not advance one inch to the east of East Germany. We will not encroach upon the other Eastern European former satrapies of the USSR. We will not seek to recruit them into NATO. NATO will not expand at your expense towards your borders. All of these promises were broken. And so Putin has had no alternative but to rearm, spectacularly rearm, to boost the military-industrial complex productive capacity, and it has done so on an astronomic scale, to expand the Russian armed forces and to arm them with the very latest of high-tech weaponry, including a modernization of the nuclear weapons fleet. That's the only choice that was left to Putin. The West responded with a raft of devastating economic sanctions, devastating to us rather than Russia, I should add. We decided that we would punish Russia financially and economically and in trade terms, that we would ensure that nothing produced by Russia would reach any Western consumer, any Western customer, even if it meant cutting off our own arms, even if it meant cutting off and blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, a vast expense constructed between Germany and Russia. We decided that Russia would be shunned in all political, cultural, and other fora. And thus we thought we'd bring Russia to its knees. But the precise opposite has happened. The Russian economy is booming while ours is slumping. The mood in Russia of patriotic and quite proper national feeling is ebullient, as anyone who's seen the pictures, the video of the various national festivals taking place in Russia over the last few weeks can testify. The mood, the spirit in Russia is ebullient, while ours in Western countries is utterly, profoundly depressed, and rightly so. We're led by the least of us. We're led by the worst of us. And that's nowhere more true than it is in France. Little Macron, I hate to call him Little Napoleon because I have quite a high regard for Napoleon and none at all for Little Macron. But the truth is, he is clearly possessed of Napoleonic dreams. He's in some kind of Napoleonic melancholia, imagining that France is a great military power, imagining that France can enter a state of war with Russia, imagining a France that can invade Odessa and hold it from the Russian advance. The great ancient Russian jewel of Odessa, of all places, occupied by the French Foreign Legion, no doubt. But the French Foreign Legion have been in Odessa before, in the war of intervention in which the British and the French, the United States, Japan and other countries tried to overturn the result of the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917. The French had responsibility for Odessa, and the then nascent Red Army, made up of sailors and soldiers, workers and peasants, and for the first time, large numbers of skilled women fighters in regiments, in battalions, even in cavalry battalions. The French were sent packing, sent homewards, just as ignominiously as Napoleon himself had been from the gates of Moscow in the early 19th century. So the stars are not aligned for Little Macron. And I knew that even before the latest opinion poll was published. And it says this, that only 24% of the people of France approve of President Macron's conduct during the Russia-Ukraine war. 24%, 76% against it. Now, we don't get the chance to vote out Macron, but he knows his tea is out. He's there still in the palace at the Élysée, but he knows his tea is out. He is for the off, his party routed at the next French elections. It's almost certain to me that the next president of France will be Marine Le Pen. In the past, all kinds of unworthy presidents have been elected precisely because they were not Le Pen, either her or her father. But I feel that we've crossed that Rubicon now in French affairs, that people want rid of the centrists, so-called self-defined. People want rid of the leaders that have led us into this parlous pass. And even if their name is Le Pen, they are going to take the opportunity of doing it. In fact, all throughout the Western world, people have tired almost simultaneously of their prevailing orthodoxy, of their uniparty system, of the two cheeks of the same backside that exists in Canada, in the United States, in Britain, in France, in Germany, and elsewhere. And people are ready to try something new, and try it they are certain to do. Joe Biden had another catastrophic week. Donald Trump had another good week. The chances of Joe Biden successfully being re-elected are now vanishingly close to zero, which made it all the more peculiar when Macron said on television that, as he understands it, Donald Trump is not going to be the next president of the United States. I wish someone had asked Macron, how do you know that, Mr. President? Do you know something the rest of us don't know? If I was Donald Trump, I'd be on the phone right now to little Macron, demanding to know what that something might be. Putin, re-elected. Biden, comprehensively defeated. Rishi Sunak, headed for the knacker's yard. Just in the last hours, it's been made clear that he will stay on, whatever his party members think. And just in case they were thinking of overthrowing him, he suddenly brought a summer general election in Britain back onto the table. He suddenly said that this parliament will not last until November. He's already said that the election will not be on May the 2nd. So that kind of only leaves the first week of June. So I'm ready for a June election. Looking forward to getting my knees brown on the streets of Rochdale. And we had a meeting today here in Rochdale in which a huge number of people became candidates for councils, but also for Parliament of the Workers' Party of Britain. Let me turn now to the situation in Palestine. It's distressing beyond words. Nusayrat refugee camp, which I know, was the scene of yet another large-scale massacre yesterday when almost 50 members of the same family were all wiped out in one single strike in 1 second. Everyone, grandmothers, grandfathers, cousins, aunts, uncles, daughters, sons, all wiped out in one explosion. They were sitting down to break their fast after the day-long Ramadan fast, which even in the conditions of hunger and starvation and illness and no clean water are being strictly and religiously observed in the Gaza Strip. They are people with very, very strong faith. But they're breaking their fast with grass soup, which, if a dash of lemon is added to it, apparently makes it palatable enough to make you feel like you've eaten something. So if you are one of those, and many of my viewers are, who has just broken their fast this Ramadan day, do remember that your fellow Muslims in Gaza are literally eating grass, if they can get hold of it, and eating it only as long as a rocket doesn't appear through their front door, eating it only as long as the building they're in isn't collapsed, pancaked by aerial bombardment from above. Eating what they can, where they can, but fully expecting to die. And one of the most powerful of all the moving videos and stories of the last few weeks is surely the last words of Mr. Barakat, the legendary, celebrated Palestinian footballer, a man of great talent, a man wanted by clubs all over the Arab world, a man from the Palestine national football team, age 34, sat in his house speaking to his telephone, telling everyone that the bombs were becoming closer and closer and closer to him in his family home. And then he was no more. "These will be my final words," he said, just before they were his final words. I mention it not because Mr. Barakat is intrinsically any more valuable, worth more in any way than all the 40,000 people almost who've now been killed, the 125,000 people who've been killed or wounded or are still disappeared under the rubble. I say it for this reason. No footballer, no football manager, no football club, no football reporter, no football pundit, no Ian Wright, no Gary Lineker, no football authority of any kind, not FIFA, not UEFA, not the FA, not one of them has even mentioned the murder on screen of the captain of the Palestine football team, recording his own death at the hands of the Air Force of a country that is still fully participating in every one of your football tournaments and competitions. Just think about that. I'll be right back with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti from Palestine with plenty important to say.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Who better to talk to about an extraordinary week, by which I mean an out-of-the-ordinary week on the Palestine track, than medical doctor, member of parliament, and many people would say the best prime minister Palestine has not yet had, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti. Welcome back to the show. I wouldn't normally seek to lead you into internal controversies, but I'm afraid I can no longer ignore what happened this week with a démarche made by, on the face of it, the president's office, certainly his part of his party, from the presidency itself, which was a savage critique against the resistance in Gaza, blaming them for the mass murder of tens of thousands of Palestinians in the last 165 days. It was a denunciation that could only be justifiable if an all-out civil war was about to be launched in the Palestinian arena, just at a time when one would have thought the Palestinians needed national unity more than anything else. What was your take on it, Dr. Mustafa? And I apologize again for dragging you into it, but everyone's talking about it. It'll look pretty strange if we don't discuss it.
Well, thank you, George, and congratulations on your success, recent success. And we consider it a success for Palestine as well. And I believe the statement you relate to, or you have mentioned, is a statement that was issued by Fatah. Although many members of Fatah have expressed their unhappiness and that they are not accepting it, which is encouraging, actually, because I am sure there are many good people in Fatah, who are patriotic and who respect the resistance and respect the what all Palestinian groups are doing. Unfortunately, that statement made three mistakes. The first one is, although it came as a response, as you know, to a previous statement made by four Palestinian political parties, including Hamas, Jihad, Palestinian National Initiative, and PFLP, criticizing the way the president is trying to construct his new government. In the sense that the criticism that was directed to the formation of the government was about the fact that what we need is a national consensus government under the circumstances where we face terrible massacres, we face Israeli reoccupation not only of Gaza but also of the West Bank, we face a second Nakba that is worse than the first one. Anyhow, the response from in that statement from Fatah was, as I said, made three mistakes. First of all, it blamed the victim, something that we do not allow, do not accept. And those who wrote such a thing, I don't know if they were in, fully conscious about what they are doing, but such a criticism or such an attack on resistance would serve only the interest of the Israelis. So that was a big mistake. Second, the statement came exactly after we had met in Moscow all the 14 different Palestinian groups, and in a very good, positive atmosphere. And we really managed to have a communique, which I myself drafted, and was accepted by both Fatah and Hamas and by all other Palestinian parties. And that indicated that we should work towards bringing in Hamas and Jihad and all other groups into the PLO so that PLO can be the place for unified Palestinian leadership and to consolidate its role as a representative of Palestinians in a fight where some others are trying to take away from Palestinians the right to represent themselves. So that statement after the meeting in Moscow was absolutely contradictory to that spirit that we had together. The third mistake, of course, that it aggravated a lot of internal dispute at a time when we are really facing a very serious challenge, very serious aggression, very serious war crimes that are committed by Israel, an act of genocide, which requires that we all should be united. And even if we disagree with each other about anything, we shouldn't transform that disagreement into an internal fight. For these three reasons, I am very sorry that this statement came out and in such a manner. And I hope that it will stop there and that we will not be dragged, any of us, into this, into internal dispute more. But the right of the political forces to express their views about political actions, like formation of a new government for Palestinians, is a right. And people have the right to say their opinion without attacking or undermining any particular group. And that's exactly what was done in that statement of the four groups that criticized the way of forming the government. In short, I want to the listeners to understand my position. In my opinion, the most urgent need internally now in Palestine is to form a national, unified national leadership that includes everybody, that unites all our forces, to stand up to the Israeli aggression and to stand up to the Israeli terrible crimes. And also to stand up to the many conspiracies worldwide, including by the United States, to deform the Palestinian structure. Second, out of this national unified national leadership, there should be a national consensus government, which means the government is not the most important thing here. The most important thing is to have the leadership. But the government has to be accepted by everybody. Otherwise, how can it work? Or how can it respond to these terrible challenges that are facing us, including the total destruction of Gaza?
Doctor, the aggression where is it going next? We're asking the question, will Netanyahu attack Rafah this Ramadan? Do you think he will?
I think if it was up to Netanyahu alone, he would. And he would. He is trying not only to attack Rafah, he's trying to continue this war for a very long time. And I think he, deep down, he's also trying to escalate the situation in the north to a full-scale war. I don't have to re-explain what was explained several times, why Netanyahu is like that, but everybody knows that at the end of the war, if the war stops, he will immediately be indicted for his huge failure on the 7th of October. And he is already indicted for 4 cases of corruption, which will take him to jail. So this man and people like Gallant and the head of the army, they are all responsible for Israel's failure on the 7th of October. So each of them is interested in prolonging this war. But on the other hand, there are lots of pressures on them. One part of the pressures is their internal now dispute with the United States, which creates the United States' efforts to undermine Netanyahu because he really insulted them in every possible way. Second, and it's very important, Israel is suffering from inability to tolerate all the human losses they are having in the battlefield. They are unable to sustain this terrible economic crisis they are in because of the war, because of this war that lasted longer than anybody would have expected, but also because of their failures. They failed. They failed to consolidate their occupation. They failed to eradicate resistance as they have dreamt. And they failed to bring back their hostages. And here comes the other pressure that they are sustaining, which is the pressure from families of prisoners who are upgrading their criticism and demonstrations against Netanyahu and actually unifying with them all the forces that want Netanyahu out. So in the middle of all of that, there are negotiations that are happening in Qatar now. And the proposals Hamas managed to be smart in their proposals. They made certain concessions that makes it very difficult for Netanyahu to reject and refuse out of the care about the situation of the people in Gaza.
This delegation that has gone to Qatar, it took a long time to be briefed, to be tasked, told what its mandate was. It begins to look to me like Netanyahu is losing the internal battle and that some kind of pause in the slaughter, at least, is highly likely in the next few days. Is that also your reading?
Till 1 hour ago, it wasn't my reading. But after reviewing the most recent reports and news, it sounds like we are closer than any other time during the last 2 months to the possibility of having a temporary ceasefire, on which one can build the possibility of ending this war. So I think, yes, we are closer, but one has to be careful because Netanyahu is a very dangerous man. He can maneuver in every possible way if he doesn't want an agreement to be reached. But I think the situation is very tight for him now. And probably and hopefully, and that would be great news for our people in Gaza, we are getting closer to the possibility of a 42 days of ceasefire.
Inshallah, as they say. Finally, your own Palestinian National Initiative was one of the organizations, one of the 4 groups that you quoted earlier, alongside Hamas, Jihad, and PFLP, yours being the secular, can I call it secular? Certainly not Islamist, not communist, Marxist, it sounds to me that the Palestinian National Initiative feels a bit like the future. Can you tell us about it? Tell us what it means, what it consists of, and what its program is.
Well, the Palestinian National Initiative for sure is sort of progressing very rapidly. And maybe I can say that the polls are showing that it is now the third force in Palestine and growing very fast. It is a democratic national movement that was founded by a group of Palestinian leaders, some of whom you know very well, like Dr. Haider Abdeshafi and Edward Said, myself and many others. And we were established on the basis of rejection of Oslo Agreement, because we saw in that agreement very big risk for the future of Palestinians, as huge mistakes made, especially the mistake of signing an agreement with Israelis without insisting on complete and total end of settlement activities. And we are now paying a price for that mistake. So it was formed to be an alternative movement. It is independent from both Fatah and Hamas. And it tries to respond to the feelings and willings and ideas of the, what we call the silent majority in the middle, which aims to see Palestine as a democratic country at the end, as a free democratic country. And our program consists of three parts. The first part is freedom, of course, how to achieve freedom. And we are proposing a very clear strategy of changing the balance of power through resistance, a lot of emphasis on popular nonviolent resistance, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel, reunifying Palestinian groups and the unified national leadership, and reunifying the efforts of all parts of the Palestinian people, those inside 48 areas in the occupied territories and in the diaspora. But the other two parts of our program is one about democratic internal transformation, because we want to see full democracy in Palestine, the right of the people to choose their leaders democratically and freely, which is something we did not have since 2006. And also a pluralistic system which allows separation of powers between judiciary, executive, and legislative, which we don't have at the moment. But also this movement has very big emphasis on social issues and social justice issues. So it pays a very big attention to the rights of the people who are poor, how to improve their situation. There is very big part of it about women's rights, about youth rights, and it is not surprising that in our movement, 80% of our members now are young people and women. So it's the youngest Palestinian movement, you could say, with lots of young people in it. And it aspires to give Palestinians another alternative. But one very important point that has been characteristic of the Palestinian National Initiative, that it shies away completely from any aspect of factionalism, and it concentrates a lot on unity. And that's why we've been able to be frequently the mediator also between Fatah and Hamas to achieve national unity.
Fantastic. Sound like our kind of guys. Thank you very much, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, MD, MP, and of the Palestine National Initiative. Thanks for joining us. Fascinating interview. I'll be right back after this. Stay tuned.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
Hikmat Abu Hatter is a Syrian-American contributor to two of the best journalistic outfits in the entire world. That's the Grey Zone and Mint Press. He's also the host of Conversations with Dissidents. We like dissidents too, Hikmat. We are fellow travellers, I have no doubt. Thank you for joining us on the Mother of All Talk Shows. It came as quite a surprise to me that in Washington, they haven't agreed to cry uncle. They still believe that they can regime change the government in Syria, and they are still prepared to sanction and starve Syrians in that pursuit. Have I got that right?
Yeah, George, thanks for having me. And I hope you don't mind the bachata music that's coming out of the background. I live in Washington Heights in New York City, and it's called Little DR, Little Dominican Republic. So let's try and focus on my voice. So as we all know, in 2019, the CSAR Sanctions Act was passed in the United States Congress. It was co-authored by Elliot Engels, representative of Bronx, not too far from here. He's one of the highest recipients of AIPAC money in the entire United States government. He received almost $2 million from them. And immediately, international organizations, the United Nations, Elena Dohan, the special rapporteur, rapporteur on sanctions and the enjoyment of a dignified humanitarian life, commented and said that these sanctions are inhumane and illegal. They are secondary sanctions. They impose sanctions on countries that do business with a sanctioned entity. They are sectoral. They target sectors as a whole. They target sectors, anything that has to do with construction, energy, finance. And we've seen the consequences of these atrocious starvation sanctions on the Syrian people. We see now that 90% of the Syrian population is below the poverty line. We see that 51% of the population is food insecure. And as I'm sure you know, you've been to Syria before. When I was young, I remember the Syrian pound exchanging 40 to 1 with the US dollar. Now it's unfortunately 15,000. So you're talking about a devaluation of about 35,000%. So the situation is nothing short of immiseration that's been intentionally targeting the Syrian civilians in Syria. Professor Joshua Landis, an expert on Syria, noted in an interview that I conducted with him, saying Bashar al-Assad, the government in Syria are eating beautifully. Now, I don't know how our president eats, but I can say for sure that the Syrian government are not eating well because of these sanctions. And I can also point out to something that's very important, that the majority of Syrians are currently living under the control of the Syrian government, which the West malignantly calls under the Syrian regime, or they call them Assadists, or they call them Assadist loyalists, or they call them Assadist apologists. Irregardless of their political positions, they live under the control of the Syrian government in proper Syria, and they are not receiving aid from the United States, like the aid that the United States sends to the canton of Al-Qaeda in Northwest or to the make-wish state of Rojava for the Kurds in the Northeast. The majority of the Syrian people, 12 million plus, are living in Damascus. They're living in Aleppo, my home city. They're living in Latakia. They're living in Tartus, in Hama, in Homs. And these people are struggling and they're suffering under this. Imagine the knee of the entire United States foreign apparatus on your neck as a miserly Syrian civilian. So as I sent you in the article that should be published today or tomorrow morning, this latest effort by the anti-Syria lobby on Washington that happened last Thursday was essentially to push for more sanctions and to extend the CSAR Sanctions Act for 8 more years. It was supposed to sunset in 2024 by the end of this year. But no, they decided that the Syrian people have not suffered enough and they should suffer for 8 more years up until 2032.
What do they imagine they can achieve by these things? They can create misery, of course. They can make more people hate them even more than they did before. But they're not going to change the government in Syria. They threw everything, including the kitchen sink, into that project and it failed. So at what point do you do as the Arab League has done in readmitting Syria to the Arab League, as the Gulf countries have done in repairing their relationships with Bashar al-Assad and his government? At what point do you say, well, we tried that and it didn't work, so we better adjust to the new realities? In other words, why is America still throwing good money after bad?
Well, first of all, George, the supposed good money that never existed did not start in 2011, nor did it start in 2019. Syria has been consistently sanctioned by the United States government ever since 1979. As you know, in 78, Egypt, in a grand betrayal to the Arab world, signed Camp David Accords with the Israeli entity, with the apartheid state. And from that day on, the entire might of the foreign state apparatus, the State Department, the Treasury, OFAC, all of Washington had been laser focused on the last symbol of Arab resistance, of Arab independence, of Arab resistance to the Zionist project in the Middle East. So from 1979, we've been added to the state sponsor of terrorism of list, and we've been the only inaugural member of that list that remains to this day. Others have left and others have joined, but we've been there all along for the last 45 years. A source of pride, I would say. And then, so 79, 94, 2003, 2012, and finally 2019, and as we speak today, 2024. It did not start with the Arab Spring. It did not start with the conclusion for the active hot war in Syria. No, it's been happening for a long time. And to answer your first question, James Jeffries, the special rapporteur, the special envoy, on Syria under the Trump administration, said something that betrayed the real purpose of what the United States wants in Syria. He said that they want to create a quagmire for the Iranians and the Russians in Syria. So they want Syria to become a Vietnam, to become a sinkhole. And in a sense, it has become that. The Syrian economy is fragile. It cannot stand on its own without Iranian, Russian support. And they've succeeded from that sense. But the final other motive that is the most pessimistic is that they want to starve the Syrian people so that the Syrian people look around them. They see no prospects for work. They see no prospects to feed their families. And they see nothing in front of them, no bread, no nothing. So they take up the brick that they see in front of them and they throw it at any authority that they see fit. So that is the purpose. They're starving the Syrian people in hopes of breaking them beyond the breaking that's already happened.
If I saw more bombing of Syria yesterday, maybe even today again, does this mean that Syria doesn't have the anti-aircraft capability of defending itself from these kind of bombing raids, or that they're not yet permitted to use it? And if it's the latter, what circumstances would need to obtain before Russia would permit the use of the kind of anti-aircraft power that could stop these bombs?
Yeah, you hit it on the nail, George. We do have the SAM systems, as you know, but the use of these systems are not in the hands of the government. At least my assessment is that they're not. And as you pointed out yesterday, we had a double-pronged attack. It wasn't just Israel. Israel struck within Syria, but at the same time, Al-Qaeda from HTS, the HTS affiliate, which is the offshoot of Al-Qaeda from Idlib region in the northwest, struck deep into Aleppo as well. So we, in the same day, we were struck from both sides, from Al-Qaeda and from the Zionist state. But yeah, currently, most of our decisions are, we'd like to say that they're independent, but we shot down one Israeli plane back in 2018, I believe. But I don't see us responding as vociferously as we should be, because the thing is, if Israel were to commit a mass bombing raid on Damascus, I unfortunately don't think anyone here in New York or anyone in Washington would bat an eye. They would not care. As we saw what they did in 2006 in Lebanon, and as we see what they're doing in Gaza today.
I could see that nobody would bat an eye in Washington. I'm wondering why they're not batting enough of an eye in Moscow.
That is a good question. And I also ask, why are they not more attentive in Beijing? I mean, Syria has been played a prominent role in breaking the thorn of Western hegemony, of Western imperialism. We saw what happened in Libya. We saw what happened in Iraq, in Somalia, etc. What happened in Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. Syria was the first success of the quote-unquote resistance of Western imperial hegemony in the region and in the world. And I'm not seeing Syria repaid for the immense burden that it carried on behalf of the free world. I'm not seeing Syria rewarded by these capitals, by Beijing and others, for the immense burden that it carried on their behalf. So I wonder as you do, how much more they would allow for the suffering of Syrians before something has to change, something breaks.
Thank you, Hikmat. Where can people see your article that's landing tonight or tomorrow?
On Gray Zone News on my Twitter. And one more thing that I want to address, George. We have a Project Onwards. We have an NGO in the United States. We're trying to launch a petition campaign. I'm Syrian American. We have a big Syrian American community in New York, in Chicago, and elsewhere in Michigan. We're trying to push for signatures. So if you can, if anyone hearing this is a Syrian American who could spare 12 seconds to sign this petition so we can have a mandate when we go to our senators, our representatives, and ask them to vote no on HR 3202, which just passed the House, or to support any form of decreasing the starvation sanctions on Syria. So that is the main thing. And as you just alluded, the article will be out later tonight or tomorrow on Gray Zone, on the Gray Zone website.
Fabulous. Hikmat Abu Hatar, thank you very much indeed. A Star Is Born, a young and clever man, Syrian-American contributor to the Gray Zone and Mint Press. Elaine is in Brighton. Let's hear from her. Go ahead, Elaine.
Hello, lovely George. Hello. Firstly, I can't stand the government.
Hi.
I can't stand Labour or Conservative, and I certainly can't stand the Reform Party. And I'll do everything I can to help you with your party, because I think you're Thank wonderful. You. Anyway, on to Gaza. I'm a bit worried about the port that the stupid Americans want to build. I'm worried that they want to push the Palestinians onto boats and shove them around the world. I want the Palestinians to stay put. I want them to stay strong. And also, I'm absolutely disgusted that Canada is advertising plots of land in Gaza to Israelis. And I'm so upset by that.
Mm. Well, it's not Canada as such, Elaine, but it's happening in Canada. And it is a deplorable, scandalous indeed. But it's not Canada that's doing it. It is Zionist campaigners who are in Canada, who live in Canada. But Canada hasn't stopped it from happening. So you're right to that extent that Canada could be held responsible for what are auctions of stolen property, not even yet secured by the thieves under their lock and key. And frankly, anybody who buys a piece of Gaza from Zionist settlers is really just giving their money away. I mean, this is just performative charity work towards Zionism. They're never going to occupy that land. They'll never have a moment's peace on it if they go and visit it. And I'd be surprised that they even ever would be able to visit it. Elaine, thanks for your beautiful call. So 28,000 people have watched, have voted rather, and overwhelmingly they think that Netanyahu is going to attack Rafah, Ramadan or not. The podcast is now a permanent fixture virtually in the top five political broadcasts across Africa, but then it's also the top English political podcast in Belize in Central America. Wow. Scan the QR code on your screen to download this week's podcast. And the last caller is Oliver in Munich on threats of war. How could I resist? Oliver, welcome.
Hi, George. First of all...
Yes, go ahead.
Of course, congratulations to your election win. It gives hope to a lot of people around the world, I think. Just a little bit about my background. I am son of Yugoslavian parents, and I from a failed country. But just where I'm from. I'm born in 1972, and I've grown up in the 70s and 80s, never worrying about nuclear war or the threat of nuclear war. But I haven't been afraid of nuclear war until now, because it seems to be so sinister. The ruling classes in America, in Great Britain, in France, etc., etc. And my mind is playing around with the idea that they could, just to prevent election outcomes in the UK and in the US, etc., just start a ground war against Russia, or go into Gaza, or even start a nuclear war just to not have certain people in power. And I haven't gotten... I've thrown
I
my...
I doubt it, Oliver. Of course, not because I don't think these people are malignant enough to do it, but I don't think that these outcomes are the desired outcomes from the point of view of the ruling elite at this point in time. I don't think they want a nuclear exchange, which would quickly become a nuclear war, which would quickly end the world and all capital, all profit therein. I don't think they want to see their own villas, their own yachts, their own fine things destroyed in a nuclear exchange. So I wouldn't over worry about that. I'm certain that they will not launch a ground war against Russia, because, hey, a lot of people have tried that before in history and it never works. I don't believe that they are going to put their own troops into Gaza because the dangers of that and the unpopularity of that are really vividly obvious to anyone and everyone. And lastly, never call Yugoslavia a failed country, please. Yugoslavia was made to fail, yes, but in its time, it was the future once, and I hope one day it will be the kind of future again where countries of different nationalities, different ethnicities, different religions can nonetheless share the same geographic, topographic space in a democratic way, with power revolving between them, and able to reconcile the many and real differences of identity. Russia has achieved it. To a very considerable extent, Russia has achieved it. China has achieved it to a very considerable extent. Under Tito, Yugoslavia achieved it. And how we could do with his presence now. I'm way over time. Oliver, thanks for calling. I don't have time to do justice to all of the issues that have been raised, nor to take even a fraction of the more than 500 telephone calls that we have received on the show this evening. If I tell you that a normal show on normal phone-in radio and TV in Britain would be lucky to receive 20 telephone calls, we have more than 500. 3.9 million people watched the mother of all talk shows in the last 7 days, including two spectacular pirates, one of which got 1.1 million hits and the other got almost 500,000. This was the clip on Kate. Kate Gate, where is she? Since the questions I asked on Wednesday, no answer has been forthcoming. And thus I have concluded that they are unable to produce the Princess of Wales, or she is unwilling to be produced for reasons which may shortly become clear, but which, if what I'm hearing is true, is filled with foreboding for the future of the British royal family. Beware the Ides of March, ye Windsors, to mix my Shakespearean metaphors. It's been marvellous for me. I hope it was for you. And if it was, come back on Wednesday at the same time, 7 p.m. UK time. It's been and will be again, God willing, the mother of all talk shows. Have a good night.